I have that right? Why don't we bow for a word of prayer before we begin? Father, I just thank you for this blessed day to be together to commemorate, like every Sunday, the resurrection of your Son, that we can remember what He has done for us in cleansing us of our sin and giving us new life. And thank you for this joyful fellowship for the brothers and sisters here. I pray your blessing on the Burn Fellowship, and that it can continue to be a light and a witness to you here in this community. And just for this opportunity that you opened up, Father, for us to be together today, that Deborah and I could meet these dear brothers and sisters. I pray you be with me in my message, that your Spirit would speak through me and give us all listening hearts and ears. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, as I said in my prayer, it's a real privilege to be here. I've been hearing about Burn Fellowship for, it must be at least 14, 15 years now. If not longer. And I mean, I'll be honest, I've heard nothing but good about you all of those years. And I thought, well, someday it'd be interesting to visit here. Never dreamed it would be this weekend. Deborah and I were up here for a wedding yesterday, is why we were here. And after the wedding was over, we were with Dean and Tanya Taylor, and Alan had come up to spend a little bit of time with them. And we had thought most of the wedding party, those who weren't in the wedding but just people had come up, would be spending Saturday night there. So we had made reservations at our motel to spend last night. And then we discovered when the wedding was over that everyone we knew anyway, was going back to their homes. And so we were going to be there alone. I'm sorry? Oh, put it up. Oh, okay. Except that it's not clipped. I'm not the handiest guy in the world. Still not clipped. How's that? Is that close enough? Okay. Yeah. That's why you don't want me working on your car or something. I can't even get a microphone clipped right. Anyway, Alan just out of the blue said, he heard us talking that, we're going to be there at the motel alone. He said, well, why don't you come over and spend the night with me? And I had no idea on earth who this guy was, you know, and I thought maybe he was old order. And you know, I asked Dean, does this guy have electricity in his house, you know? Anyway, we all met and had a cup of coffee together, and I'm just being, you know, really lighthearted with him. Again, I did not know him from Adam. And anyway, we got ready to come, and Dean pulled me aside and said, this is, you know, one of the leaders at Burn, you know. I thought, okay, this is a little different. So I took things a little bit more seriously, I think, from that point. But it is amazing how God will work. But he uses people. You know, if it wasn't for his hospitality and just kindness to seize a moment, yeah, we wouldn't be here. We would be no doubt at one of the beachy churches there at Fort Wayne and that. So I can really bless you as a congregation for. If he's indicative of the type of leaders you have, of just servant leaders, people who are really hospitable and loving, I mean, that really came through. I appreciated the testimonies I heard. One of the things I really liked about what both persons said was you know, being raised in a Christian home they spoke well of their parents. It's become almost commonplace nowadays to speak poorly of your parents. And some of us don't have godly parents, and I recognize that. But I hate that it's become such a trend that almost people's testimony, they almost have to form it that, you know, yeah, my parents, you know, didn't really, you know, grow up in a very godly home. My parents didn't set a very good example and you know, that kind of thing. And again, I'm not saying that that's never appropriate or something. But it is nice when we can honor our parents and look for ways to do that, even when they are imperfect. When God gave the commandment to honor our father and mother, I mean, He wasn't talking about a bunch of godly parents. I mean, He's talking about the Israelites in the wilderness, who He knew He was going to leave there in the wilderness. But that was beside the point. That didn't have anything to do with it. You know, it was, you wouldn't be in this world if it wasn't for them. If they don't do anything else for you, you know, and if they're even living an ungodly life, you simply would not exist if it wasn't for them. They have participated in that original act of creation that started with Adam and Eve, and just for that alone, it's reason to honor them. And so, like I say, I appreciate what was shared, and the. I also appreciate what was said about not having to have a testimony. In fact, we shouldn't have one about how I left the Lord and went into this life of sin and all these horrible things I did, and then, you know, got saved from that. Again, I mean, that happens, and if that's our testimony, you know, then you know, fine. God can bring us back from there. But when we're raised in a Christian home, even with imperfect Christian parents, the norm should be that, yeah, I grew up in a fairly godly atmosphere, but all of us, yeah, still need Christ. You know, that no matter how straight a life that we lived, nobody can save themselves. There's no salvation apart from the blood of Christ. And we all have to come to that point of surrender and being born again, accepting his forgiveness, entering into that relationship. But it is wonderful to give a testimony that, yeah, I didn't have this horrible life of sin, just the ordinary imperfections. That should be the typical testimony. But like I say, people feel like, oh, I've got to give this one of how terrible my life was. And sometimes it almost comes across as something proud that, you know, yeah, I was so wicked and ungodly. Well, if that's the case, we shouldn't be proud of it, you know. It should be something we're ashamed of, particularly if we grew up in a Christian home and that sort of thing. So anyway, like I said, I wanted to just express that appreciation for what was shared. And it ties in with the message that I wanted to talk about. Now, I wasn't in the least bit prepared to speak this morning, and yet I... When I got to thinking of driving over here and I realized this is, okay, one of the elders here in the church here, I'm guessing he's maybe wanting me to speak, and I'd rather find out now and not be asked, you know, Sunday morning, would you come up here and share? So I asked him, you know, are you wanting me, would you like me to speak? And I said, but I didn't bring an outline or anything, so it will be a little bit off the cuff. And he said, fine, he was going to talk with the other elders and let me know. Now, part of this message I gave a couple of months ago in our church, so it's not totally something I haven't given a lot of thought to. And then the other half of it I'm planning to give next Sunday in our church, but I haven't prepared it yet. So you're going to get kind of a very off-the-cuff version of it. And the other complication is, Alan was asking me last night, we were coming home from his brother's house, and he said, what were you planning to speak about tomorrow? And I said, well, I thought I'd give a message on Abraham, and it's going to be on maybe a little different aspect than the way he's often preached about it. And I said, do you think there'll be any problem? He said, no, but I've been speaking about Abraham do you preach every week, or how does it work here? Once a month. So you've been hearing, you know, his messages on Abraham. And I said, Oh, boy, you know, I might be giving the exact opposite of what you've been telling the congregation. And he said, that's fine. That's just fine. And I decided, you know, I'm not going to ask him what he's been saying on the parts I'm going to be speaking on. So I have no idea if I'm contradicting him or not. But I appreciate his humility that he doesn't mind if I do contradict him. Of course, I realize he has the last word because I'll be gone and he can contradict me then the next time he gets up here. So, but hopefully we'll be seeing things that all mesh together and can learn from one another. But the reason that I mentioned about honoring our parents, I'm working right now on an Anabaptist study Bible. It has bothered me for a long, long time that we have become totally, and I mean totally, dependent on the evangelical Protestant world for everything. Our Bible translations, our hymns, our Bible dictionaries, Bible commentaries, study Bibles, everything like that. And we have very few reference materials that come from a kingdom perspective or from an Anabaptist perspective. So I thought maybe this is something God would have me do, and he seems to be blessing me in that direction. And the last 2 years I've been spent just researching and going back, rereading the early Christians. I read all of their writings, or all the ones we have back. It had been over 30 years ago. And I thought, I'd like to read them again, see what I might see this time through that perhaps I didn't catch the first time. And also read some other writings from that time period, from the Jews and from the Roman writers, to better understand the world that they lived in and how the Bible message fits into that world. But everything in the study Bible is going to be based on a historical source. What a lot of people don't realize, what in fact probably most people don't realize, because I didn't realize it, is when you pick up a commentary and they say, well, now back then, this is how things were, blah, 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 almost always it's made up. It's hard to believe, but I guarantee you it is nearly always made up. I don't mean that this person is trying to lie to you. He's heard it somewhere, and that person heard it somewhere else, and that, you know, and it floats around. And yet they can't give you a source. Now, yeah, it's just something that sounds good, that fits in, and we go with. And often then that gets preached as fact, and we've heard it so much, we assume it is fact when it's, yeah, totally, totally bogus. So it's one reason, like I said, I wanted to go back and see, okay, how did people understand the New Testament, the ones who were right after the apostles? How did the Jews understand their writings? People like Josephus, Philo, not that they necessarily had a proper perspective, but just how did they look at things of the Jews in Jesus' day? I mean, we know what we have in the New Testament, which really the New Testament, I will tell you, is our best source of background information about life back then. People have the idea that, oh, there's a bunch of other stuff. Really, there isn't. People don't tend to write about daily life. They tend to write about big historical events. Where the New Testament, you don't read about too many big things, what's happening in the palace in Rome. You read about it everyday life. And so it's really our best background source on that. But the thing I noticed in reading through the early Christian writings a second time through, that... am I doing something wrong here? I keep getting the, but it's okay. If it's not bothering any of you, it's not bothering me. Yeah, we'll just live with it. No, it's not mic feedback. It's just like, you know, the wind or something on, you know. One of the things that really stood out in both the early Christian writings and the Jewish writings was the deep reverence and honor that they paid to their forefathers, to godly men and women of old. I mean, we all do to a certain degree, but this went beyond what I had seen. I don't mean worshiping these men, but a type of honor that we're not so used to giving in our society today, because it has become, particularly in the world, the end thing to put down your parents and to talk about, yeah, how bad your dad is, or your mom didn't do this, or that sort of thing. And that, and again, sometimes those things are true, but it's almost become a cliche, you know, your parents were so bad, and that's come into the Christian world. And we have lost that respect of reverencing the aged. I was talking to a Japanese sister, by email, who she and her husband have been working with Dean and Tanya Taylor over there in Greece, and will be working with them more. And one of the things she commented to me, she was surprised, you know, when she first met Anabaptists, she was expecting us that we were these extremely exalted Christians, because she had just read about us. Was all, and you don't read about the imperfections so much. You tend to read the good things. And yeah, she was, I don't think from a critical heart, just, you know, she was all excited and expecting all of us to be out of this world. And yeah, she saw imperfections, and the group over there isn't one of the more plain groups. It's a little bit more, I think, liberal than any of us would be. But one of the things she noticed was just the lack of respect for teachers that was different in the society she grew up in the secular society. You know, in Japan, and so much of the East, you know, you really have a lot of respect for elderly people. Doesn't matter who they are. And it doesn't matter if they're an unbeliever or not. As a Christian, you respect your grandparents because they're your grandparents, and you are respectful to an older person just because they're an older person, and that. And it was just really surprising to her and her husband, her husband is from the Mideast, from Iran. And again, the same kind of culture, which would have been a lot more similar to the culture of the Bible than the Western culture that we know. And it sort of stood out with me just, again, how they respected the apostles. The men who came after them, where I'd seen in churches today, it's very typical to just run them down. People obviously feel very superior to them. And somehow we think if God was writing a very candid account of our life, that it would be this wonderful thing. I mean, on paper we'd say, no, yeah, we know it wouldn't be that way. But obviously, we imagine that when we start looking at people critically in the scriptures, when, you know, we're getting to see their faults, because, you know, the scriptures are just very black and white. I mean, they don't paint anything over, they don't whitewash it, and that sort of thing. And wow, how any of us would look. I would not want my life, you know, written there in the scriptures. I mean, there'd be so many things God could point out that would be absolutely true. That, yeah, people could look at me and think, well, why would God even use that person at all, you know? So it was kind of a check on me of, wow, my parents are now passed away, but I was always very respectful. I did grow up in a time where you were taught, you know, even in public school, you know, to respect your parents and that sort of thing. And I'm glad for that. And churches I was part of taught that as well. But yeah, I could have gone further than what I did. But now how this comes to our subject of Abraham was, I noticed both in the Jewish writings and in the Christian writings, just, wow, the deep, deep respect that they had for him and for other faithful men of old, but particularly Abraham, who's called the father of our faith. What a title. I mean, can you imagine any of us being singled out that way, that he's the father of our faith? He wasn't the first believer. It doesn't mean that. But there was something extremely special about him that God saw. And God sees things in a different light than often we do. And I noticed in the devotional reading in Isaiah today, I'm sure Alan caught that, of Abraham, my friend. Think about that. God singling you out. I can't picture him saying, you know, David Berceau, my friend. I'm David Berceau, the forgiven in Christ. And I'm thankful for that. But that just wouldn't happen. That God would single me out that way. And Isaiah was written, 1,000 years or so after Abraham. And it's still Abraham, my friend. That is a unique designation. And God saying, imagine the creator of the universe. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That he brings himself down to tie his name in to these humans who were imperfect. I mean, you know, they were not infallible men. But what an incredible honor. I mean, he doesn't say, you know, I'm the God of David, Alan, and, you know, Paul or whatever. We're talking about us, not the biblical ones. Yeah, this is a unique honor that he paid these men. And so I noticed, when they were talking about their lives, they were very careful in saying anything critical. Not because they thought these men were without sin, but they recognized, the Christians, if this is the father of the faith, and for the Jews, this is the friend of God, he's somebody that we talk about with very deep respect. And you see that in Jesus' day. You know, our father is Abraham. You know, now they were saying it when he says, you know, if Abraham was your father, you'd be doing the works of Abraham, and they weren't. Account of Lazarus, the beggar Lazarus, and he's in Hades, and, you know, it says the rich man is in Hades, and he looks up, he sees Lazarus in Abraham's bosom, you know, and, you know, he talks to Abraham, Father Abraham. What an exalted position that, you know, Christ places Abraham in. And then to say, you know, he would be sitting down in the kingdom with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jesus Christ, imagine saying that singling you out, and that he would be, you know, sitting down and eating with you in the kingdom of God. And yet, I would say so much of my adult life, when I've heard messages about Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, any of the three, so often these men are just run down as poor examples of, and they're used of what we don't want to be like and that sort of thing. In fact, what prompted these messages, like I said, I gave the first part of this. And what time do you end? I know you gave me a time. Okay, so they'll just bring lunch in here then as I'm speaking yeah, it won't be 12:45. Yeah, you can. Okay. A brother's doing a Sunday school series of lessons on Joseph in our congregation, and he's another, you know, really admirable figure in the Old Testament. But he started off, and I'm not blaming him in the least, because this is what he's heard all of his life. He says, you know, it's amazing Joseph turned out the way he did. He came from a dysfunctional family, and look at his grandfather and his great grandfather, and it's just, isn't it amazing how Joseph turned out, you know, compared with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know. And then in the course of Sunday school, we're talking about the history, and he was actually he's not a visitor. He's not a member of our church, but he's been coming for about a year, you know, just from the local community. He comes from a Protestant background, and Yeah, he said, Isaac, he was just a carnal man, you know, and Jacob was just a scoundrel, you know, and I'd heard all of that before, you know, and anyway, just listening to all of this, I thought, okay, I defended them in Sunday school, and I thought, I was preaching the next Sunday, and I thought, I am going to present a little bit different view on them, because this is not right that these men are spoken of that way. This is not how God talks about them, and it's certainly not how Christians spoke about them in the beginning. And when we do that, no matter how humble we say, you know, and we recognize how sinful we are, it does reveal we see ourselves up here and Abraham down here. I mean, it does give ourselves away. Now, like I say, the awkwardness of this, I have no idea what he was saying about Abraham during the last several months. So if I say something, you know, very different, I'm imperfect too. So maybe there's a side different. But let's go real. I think we know his greatness of Abraham. Why he's called the father of the faith. I mean, first of all, he's asked to leave his homeland, his family, and journey to a land, as it says in Hebrews, he didn't even know where he would be going. And that would be a very hard thing. You've been living in a city, and now you're going to be dwelling in tents in a land that's not... there are green parts of Israel, you know, along the Jordan River and some of the other valleys and that sort of thing. But in general, it's a pretty dry, arid place, and not the ideal place to be out, you know, having to live wandering in tents and that sort of thing on land that you don't own. He never owned anything that he could call his plot of land, except for the burial place for Sarah. You know, he had to buy that. You know, he didn't own anything at that point. And then I think the hardest test God has ever put on a human, you know, offer up your only son. Dying for the faith isn't easy. None of us obviously have done it, but. Plenty of Christians have done that, and I think if the time came, I would find torture pretty difficult. But dying for the faith, you know, is a test. I think most of us would be able to pass. But wow, take your only son and kill him. Now that would be very, very difficult. Yet Abraham, I mean, there's no, like, no God, no, I'm not, you know, there's no fighting, there's no nothing. He just does it, you know. And even though it's like, well, wait a minute, I thought you were going to raise him up to be a great nation. As Paul points out, it shows he believed in the resurrection, you know. So it's not, like I say, no reason he's called the father of our faith. Now, in Genesis Chapter 12, verses 10 through 15. Let's read that together. Alan, you promised me something about a glass of water up here. Thank you. You did a wise thing. He was up here. I'd probably knock it off. I usually do that. Okay. Genesis 12, verses 10 through 15. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai his wife, Behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore, it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, This is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. And it came to pass that when Abram was coming to Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Now we'll stop there. And I have no idea what Alan said on that passage. But we have a very similar situation after that. Genesis 20. He told me he got through chapter 17 or was about to start chapter 17. So I know he hasn't preached on this yet. So Genesis 20, 1 through 18, which is the entire chapter. And we'll just look at this together. Now, as we're reading, I want you, you know, most of the sermons, boy, when we read this, it is nothing but, you know, this cowardly Abraham, lack of faith and everything else. As we're reading, I want you to just be thinking, okay, this is the father of the faith. This is somebody who God really respects, and it's somebody we can look up to and we can learn from this situation. All right. And so maybe our first impulse that we would think of, if we didn't know that God says, this is my friend, we might think differently. It starts off, and Abraham journeyed from thence toward the south country and dwelled between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned in Gerar. And by the way, I wanted to mention, I forgot, when we were talking about Egypt, one of the things that shows Abraham's faith in that is, imagine, you know, God tells him to go, come to this land. He gets there. He's there for, I don't know, a few years, maybe not that long, and they have a famine. Now, it would have been so easy to pack up and go back home. Ur is north of Israel. But he doesn't go north. He goes south. In other words, he had no plans to, I'm going back home or something. He's going to some place that he's only going to be there a while, and he's going to come back to this land God has promised him, that he's still wondering, how is this all going to happen, what God had told him. But just in there, we can see a man of faith that, yeah, he doesn't do the natural thing. Okay, it says, and Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister, and Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, behold, thou art but a dead man, for the woman which thou hast taken, for she is a man's wife. But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, Lord, will thou slay also a righteous nation? Said he not unto me, she is my sister, and she even... she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this. And God said unto him in a dream, yea, I know that thou did this in the integrity of thy heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me. Therefore suffered I thee not to touch her. Now therefore restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet. You know, this is the first time anyone is called a prophet in the Bible. And he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live. And if thou restore her not, know that thou shalt surely die, thou and all that are thine. Therefore Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their ears. And the men were sore afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said unto him, what hast thou done unto us, and what have I offended thee, that thou hast brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin, that thou hast done unto me that thou ought not to be done? And Abimelech said unto Abraham, what sawest thou that thou hast done this thing? And Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. And yet indeed she is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is thy kindness which thou shalt show unto me. At every place whither we shall come, say of me, he is my brother. And Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah his wife. And Abimelech said, behold, my land is before thee, dwell where it pleaseth thee. And unto Sarah he said, behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all other. Thus she was reproved. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. For the Lord had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now let's look at just going into the next chapter. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. Now the thing you notice in both Egypt and here, God never expresses any displeasure with Abraham at all. Both times, God's wrath is against the king who is involved. I was reading something just in this past year, a Bible newsletter I get from a man I respect very, very much. And, you know, he starts off, yeah, Abraham was a liar and a coward. And you know, it's just like, whoa, the disrespect that we show. He was not a liar. He did not lie at all. Sarah was his sister. She was also his wife, but she was his sister. Just like when later on we read about Joseph and his brothers, you know, it says his brothers came down and visited him in, you know, Egypt to get the to buy grain. Well, none of those who came down the first time were his full brothers. They were all half brothers, but neither Hebrew or Greek had a term for half brother. I mean, you were a brother or a sister. So, yeah, first of all, Abraham did not lie when he did this. Number two, he was anything but a coward. I think Alan has already covered the account where Lot was taken. Now imagine, here is a guy, Abraham. He's not a man of war. He's just a shepherd, herder of sheep. And his nephew is taken by these kings, by these armies. Now, how many people would have the courage to just take his servants and with them go and chase after these armies that had conquered fortified cities, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah and those other cities there. I think it was five cities, if I remember correctly. And he chases after them and routs the army. Now, this is no coward. You don't do that, you know, if you're a person who's just a fearful, scared person. Deborah and I were blessed a few years ago to actually see the gates there. It says he went all the way to the gates of what? Dan. Yeah, that's right. And those are still, they've uncovered them. They're part of an ancient wall. Boy, I mean, it is so old, the brick and everything. And the gates got bricked in over the years to just help fortify the wall. But they're still there, the gates that date back to the time of Abraham. It's fascinating to be able to see that. Today, and just the faith that what it says there, that yeah, we can still see the very place that was spoken of. But yeah, one of the commentaries I looked at said, now Abraham had no reason to think they would kill him and take Sarah as their wife. I thought to myself, now what do you know? This was somebody who lived in the 1800s, the commentator. Now, what do you know about ancient life? You didn't live in the days of Abraham. I mean, why do you just dismiss what he says like, oh, this guy is just some, you know, fearful guy afraid of his shadow. If Abraham says they'll kill me and take you as their wife, I think we should start off believing Abraham that that's exactly what they would do, which would be bad not just for him, but for Sarah. Do you think she wanted to end up the wife of some pagan king and be part of that king's harem and all of that? They were one flesh. It was something that benefited them both. Now, the other thing I learned from reading Josephus, I believe, reading a Jewish writer, and also in reading the Roman writings, laws of Rome. This isn't Rome, this is long before, but it appears to be all of ancient culture, whether it was Jewish, Roman, Greek, whatever, that when a man was the head of his household, okay, when he died, then the headship did not pass to the mother if she were living. It passed to the oldest son. And he then stepped in the role. It came with privilege and responsibility. He was responsible now for his widowed mother, and he was responsible for the rest of the family, but particularly any unmarried daughters. It was the son's responsibility to approve of them getting married to somebody, finding a wife for them, a husband, I mean, and that sort of thing. And you see that just not very long in the case of Laban. When Abraham's servant, who's also named Abimelech, goes, he talks to Laban. See, Rebekah's father had died, and now Laban, the oldest son, it's his responsibility then to say yes or to say no. Now he, you know, asked Rebekah, "Do you want to go?" and all of that. But he could have ultimately said no to the thing. So the oldest son was then responsible to protect the chastity and to find a husband. Okay, so when Abraham says truthfully, you know, has Sarah say, "This is my brother," that didn't mean, "Hey, I'm free. I'm just out here," you know. That meant he's my guardian. You know, if you're interested in marrying me, you can go and you talk to him, and we work out a bride price and all that. If he says yes, so. Why God is angry with Pharaoh and with Abimelech is they obviously didn't do that. I mean, do you think Abraham would have said, yeah, sure, take my sister and all that? No, they just came and took her. Okay? That's the sin that they committed. Yeah, they both said, well, I didn't know it was his wife. They didn't know that. But they knew this was her brother and that they just took her anyway as their wife. And that is why God is angry with both of them and punishes both of them. He doesn't punish Abraham. In fact, it's right after the event in Egypt, when they come back into the promised land, that God renews his whole promise with Abraham. I'm going to give you this land. I mean, he's not angry with him. And then after the account with Abimelech, what happens is immediately this is when Isaac is born after that. So, like I say, it's easy to look through this with human eyes in a different culture and also with the influence of the code of chivalry. You know, a guy shouldn't, you know, he's supposed to be the big macho guy and for him to depend on his wife here to help save his life. Well, that doesn't fit into that whole culture. But yeah, that's not God's culture here. He was protecting them both. It protected Abraham, but Sarah from, you know, having her husband killed and then being taken. I think there's no reason to doubt that what Abraham is saying is true. That's exactly what they would have done. And what is he supposed to do? I mean, I've heard so many messages from Protestant evangelicals, you know, on that. And they say, yeah, this cowardly man, he's so afraid that, you know, he'll get killed and the king will take his wife. Why didn't he just trust in God? Now, those very same Protestant ministers, when they hear that we're non-resistant, and like in my house, I have no guns. If someone came in to attack my wife, I would have no way to protect her, and I wouldn't have any plan to protect her other than to pray to God. And what do Protestants say? That's terrible. You mean you wouldn't protect your wife and all that? The very ones who said, well, why didn't Abraham trust in God? Well, why don't you trust in God for your family's protection? You don't. You know, you talk real big, but the truth is, you know, and God gave him no specific promise that, you know, whatever happens, you know, I'll be there, you know, to protect you. He didn't give that promise to Abraham. So he had to use wisdom. And yet it's amazing he did it without lying. Just often that happens in persecution. You know, if you're hiding a brother or something, they come to your house. Maybe to save a brother's life, lying would be the right thing to do. I don't know. But the ideal is to not do, you know, protect your brother without lying. You can mislead somebody when their intent is evil. And Jesus did that, you know, when he went up to the Passover. His brother said, are you going up? And he says, no, I'm not going at this time. Well, they're assuming that means he's not going to the Passover. Well, then when they go, they were unbelieving, then Jesus does go. You know, so, you know, he didn't lie, but he did mislead them. Now, don't take that and say, oh, yeah, to benefit myself, I can mislead you. And we're not talking about that. We're talking about when someone's life's at stake or something like that. So don't take that very far. But I think we can look at what Abraham and Sarah did. She trusted Abraham. She reverenced him. And in doing that, not only was his life preserved, but hers as well. And in both instances, you find out Abraham is blessed that both times God brings material prosperity to him through this. So, I mean, there's no indication in the scripture that God is displeased with Abraham. So, I think we can keep that in mind. And, hey, this is the father of our faith. Okay, let's, instead of looking with critical eyes, let's assume everything he's doing is right. Again, not that he's infallible. Now, the other one that I've heard a lot, and again, there's really no justification is with Hagar. Let's turn to chapter 16 of Genesis. Genesis 16. And we're just going to read verses 1 through 4. And it says, now Sarai, Abraham's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarah said unto him, behold now, I'm reading from Genesis 16. Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abraham hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. So, what I hear so often, and any apologies if this is how you presented it, but and if you did, I mean, like I say, you almost couldn't, because every commentary, every study Bible, every book you ever read, you know, look at the lack of faith in Abraham. Instead of trusting in God, doing it God's way, he had his own plan. He followed his own plan. You know, I mean, I've heard that over and over, and it's like, I mean, nowhere in here you go through it. Does God ever chastise Abraham or say you did something wrong? I see instead faith on the part of both Abraham and Sarai. God said, I'm going to give this to your seed. Okay, they've been there 10 years. She hasn't conceived. Okay. And it's Sarah's idea, all right, have children through my handmaid. That was, in those days, that was acceptable to God. And it was a fairly normal course of action. No one was doing anything wrong. There was no lust involved here or anything. She became his wife, it said, and she conceived. I don't even know that that was necessarily outside of God's plan for things. And the reason I say that is we know how everything turns out. We have the benefit of hindsight. God deals with us, you know, by free will, and not always using his... He knows what happens in the future, but it would be really an uncomfortable situation if God dealt with us the way he knows things are going to turn out in our life. Now, you know, Alan is your pastor. I mean, he's this, you know, seems to be, you know, this wonderful brother and all that. Now, unknown to any of us, I mean, maybe, you know, when he's my age, he's going to stumble, lose his faith in God. I mean, you know, we don't know that. Well, should God, because he knows how things are going to turn out, you know, well, no, I'm going to, you know, I'm not even going to let Alan even get saved, you know, because I know how he's going to turn out, you know. Or Judas, should he not have been chosen because God knew how it would turn out? Or Saul, he shouldn't have been chosen as king because God... See, he doesn't work that way. He deals with us the way that we are is the normal thing. And I don't know that it could not have come through Ishmael. What I do see is that when the prophecy is given. It says he's going to be a, I forget it, how the King James words it, you might remember, Alan, a zebra of a man or something. I've seen different translations, but your hand will be, everyone's hand will be against you and your hand will be against everybody. Okay, that's not a very nice prophecy. Now, we have free will, so when we read that, God isn't saying, I'm going to make you into this kind of person that, you know, you're not going to get along with anybody. He sees that this is the kind of person Ishmael is going to turn out to be. So now, if Ishmael had had a godly heart, maybe God would have used him. See, I mean, there's nothing that said it had to come through somebody else. And so I think it's very reasonable to believe that, yeah, Ishmael had the opportunity, but God saw in him, no, this is not somebody who's going to be a man of faith. He's going to continue. And so, yeah, he's not acceptable. I'm going to go another means, and we're going to give a miraculous birth through Sarah and that. I don't know. But there's nothing that indicates that Abraham, any lack of faith. In fact, it would have maybe looked the opposite, you know, through your seed. Well, okay, my wife's barren, and now she's beyond the age of childbearing. So, somewhere faith and works come together. I mean, you just keep praying, God, pop up a child, or do you, you know, marry somebody else in a time when that was, you know, perfectly acceptable in order to have children because you believe God's promise that through your seed, you know, this land is going to be given. Yeah, there's nothing there that he did anything out of the order. And, you know, God doesn't condemn Ishmael. He does bless him as much as he can do. I'm going to make you into a great nation. Unfortunately, I can't give the promises to you because you're going to be this kind of guy who's, you know, doesn't get along with anybody, you know, and I can't do that. But I will make a great nation out of you. And he does do that for Ishmael. So I mentioned these things. And again, like I say, my apologies if this is the exact opposite of what you said. But it's what I hear preached everywhere. I mean, I've been hearing it for at least 40 years. You know, it's not any particular person. It's in every commentary. It's in everybody who preaches. And I don't know why, because in none of these instances do you read, and God was displeased with Abraham, and God told Abraham this and that. You don't read that. We put that in there, and we talk about Abraham like he was a man who didn't have faith. And the ones preaching, like, well, I would have been different if I had been there, you know, because, you know, I do everything God's way, and, you know, Abraham went and did it his way, you know. And I remember a preacher, and he was somebody who I respect a lot. He and I were very good friends, and, yeah, I heard that whole thing on Hagar and all of that. And I didn't say anything to him. You know, I was partly influenced by that too, myself, you know. But I remember talking to him. He was an Assembly of God pastor, and about the head covering, you know, because Deborah was wearing one at that time. We didn't belong to a plain church. There weren't any plain churches right near us. And so, you know, the subject came up and everything. I asked him about, yeah, was he going to preach it in his church? And he said, well, you know, the problem is there's not an equivalent commandment for the brothers. You know, it commands the sisters to cover their heads when they're praying. But yeah, there's nothing for the men. And I said, well, it does say it's wrong for man to cover his head. So there is, you know, two sides of it. Yeah, but that still doesn't do it, you know. It's like, wow, so that's how we choose what commands we preach, that, okay, well, this doesn't seem to fit men and women equally, so therefore I can't preach that. And I thought about, well, for what, nearly 2,000 years, God commanded men they had to be circumcised. There was no equivalent commandment for women. And you don't find the men saying, well, hey, that's not fair. I mean, that just applies to us. And then, you know, when God gives a command, you follow the command. And if you're a preacher, you preach what God tells you. But you're criticizing Abraham and saying, well, he's got his own plan and he didn't do. And then you got something where it's clear what God's commandment is, and then you're coming up with this thing, well, you know, it's not really quite balanced. It's not really fair. I didn't say anything, but I wanted to say, let's be honest. If you preach this in your church, you'd get a firestorm from the sisters. And, yeah, you're a little afraid of that. And I can understand in a conventional church, it would be pretty tough, you know, on you, you know. So, yeah, let's just be honest, you know, and if we're going to talk about cowardice, you know, maybe let's all look at ourselves. So I'm going to, like I say, this is a bit impromptu, but, yeah, I hope it'll just give you something to think about, not just with Abraham, but when God points out people as men or women of faith, yeah, let's look at their life. Okay, what can we learn from it? And when they're in difficult situations, okay, how did they deal with that? And if God doesn't condemn it, now, you know, sometimes God doesn't say anything, and it doesn't mean he approves, but, yeah, when he actually intervenes miraculously, I mean, in both situations, he intervened on Abraham's behalf miraculously, and he both times used it to give Abraham blessing, it doesn't seem that he is upset with Abraham. He's upset with these men who just went and grabbed a woman that, okay, you don't have a husband, good. I'm going to just take you as my wife. That gave them, there was nothing in any law that gave anybody the right to do that. But Abraham was a stranger. Okay, yeah, no one knows you. I can take your sister and I'm not going to get any flack because no one knows you. Now, if I took this guy's sister, yeah, that would be a huge thing and maybe the people would rise up and overthrow me. But yeah, you're just a stranger in the land. I'll just do what I want, you know. And so I think that's why God was angry with them. All right, how do you close this? Do you ask for feedback? Do I step down at this point? All right. I will turn this over to the moderator.